I have several questions that I received, and we'll go through them hopefully today. May have to save one or two of them for tomorrow. But before I start really my class, those of you that were able to be out there last night, that was just a delightful time. I'm pretty sure Junior's not in our midst, but thank you, Junior, and thank you, everybody. That was just, the weather was nice. I had some of the best visits I had all week out there, and all of the events have been very nice. If it's possible, you've gone above and beyond, but we appreciate it. I want to just get just a little running start from yesterday. I'm not going to go back into a lot of the things I brought up because they've been touched on in various classes. And as Wade goes through the Sermon on the Mount, some of them will get touched on, and that's good. But I just want to kind of get our perspective, and then I'll go into some of the questions. We talked about some of the effects of Satan's attacks. I listed purity of the church, discipline issues of the church, sexual laxity, and these three really can kind of interrelate. The MDR, marriage, divorce, remarriage. And I just ended on this one, and I don't really have a lot to say about it other than I am so thankful for the many good leaders we have in our congregations. If you are from a congregation with men that are qualified and willing to lead, you need to be very thankful to them, and you probably would do well in your Christian walk to express that. But I do find that one of the most difficult things congregations face are finding qualified men, and sometimes it's due to some of the issues that are listed just above it. And for those of you that are younger, that is a wonderful thing to have as a goal in your life, is to be able to serve the Lord in whatever way it works out. And if leadership of an official status is in the cards for you, shall we say, that's wonderful. But even if it's not, leadership is something that we are all involved in. I believe we're all leaders because there are people watching us to see how they should conduct themselves. Those of you that are teenagers, you are leaders because those little kids downstairs are watching you. And it's just something that we need to keep in mind. I also dealt with some of the ways that Satan seems to be attacking the church today. And this is going to lead into my first question. But the truth must dominate the church, therefore attacks on truth are attacks on the church. Sometimes the church, and I'm not really speaking about our brotherhood, I don't see this too much, if at all, but religious organizations, they get commercialized in their organization, in their programs. I do not believe the strength of the church lies in its programs. I believe the strength of the church lies in its virtue. A trendy approach to religion. We see that, and we could talk and cast stones, even though they be true stones, at other religious organizations. Worship goals, and I mentioned this, and this is going to lead into the first question that I am going to address this morning. We need to have doctrinal steadfast and spiritual discernment. This was all on the slides that I listed, showed you yesterday. But I did receive a question, and the question was along this. Please concisely share your thoughts on goals of worship, or what I meant by that. Well, the operative word there probably is concisely, which I won't do. But I do think it's a good question, and I think it deserves a little bit of consideration, so I want to do that. The Old Testament, the primary word for worship is shaka, and it means to bow down. In the New Testament, the primary word is proskuneo, which means to kiss toward. There are some other words, Greek words, that are translated worship or carry the same idea. They're listed there. But the gist of what I want to get out of this slide is worship in its rudimentary form is to bow down and to show affection, reverence, and awe, kiss toward, if you will. So for me, worship is the reverence and devotion that we show towards something. And I said something because you can worship things other than God. Obviously, in the Christian worldview, that should be what the object of our worship is. But worship, in its most basic sense, is reverence and devotion, a homage to something. Therefore, if I was to give you a definition of what I consider worship to be, it would be to honor, reverence, and homage in thought, feeling, and action to a being or thing, but specifically and supremely to a deity, and in Christianity, that is the God that we understand from the Bible. Sometimes we think of worship by its parts, but they are not necessarily worship per se. Obviously, our public worship service consists of songs. It consists of prayers. It consists of scripture. It consists of the Lord's Supper or communion. It consists of teaching and exhortation. And I think there is a biblical basis for the reason we do all of those. But we could do all of those and still not worship, because worship is not only the action, worship is also the thought and the attitude that goes into it. There are a multiplicity of things that I think can kill or detract from our worship. I'm going to only list two. One of them is if our worship, or if our activity that we are calling worship, is man-centered rather than God-centered. And a lot of what people today call worship, I think, is probably man-centered. What do we get out of it rather than God-centered? God's place is to be at the center of our worship and at the center of our hearts. And if it is not, then I don't consider it to be true worship. Secondly, pragmatism. This concept of whatever works, we'll do whatever it takes to fill the building. That's a situation where God, not man, has determined what worship should be. And I believe worship is not for man, although there are benefits of worship for man. The focus of worship is God. We are called to a God-centered spiritual worship. I do not believe you can worship without, or you can't worship without emotion. Now, when I say we can't worship without emotion, that is different from emotionalism. I believe emotion should come from our reverence and homage to God. I don't know how you can truly reverence and place God where He ought to be and not have an emotional response to that, of thankfulness, of awe, of reverence. But that is different than having our emotions guide our worship. I believe our faith generates our emotion rather than our emotions generating our faith. I don't believe you can worship without reverence, because that's one of the essential aspects of it. I do not believe you can worship without sacrifice. Now, obviously, we don't sacrifice bulls and goats, but we sacrifice time. We sacrifice energy. Remember David said when he was going to buy, wanted that land, I've got to paraphrase, I've got to pay for it because there has to be a sacrifice on my part. And sometimes we may try to worship without sacrificing much time or much preparation or much thought or much energy. And when we do that, I question whether or not that is what the Lord is looking for. I do not believe we can worship without a pure heart. Psalms 24 verses, I guess it could be verses 3 and 4, but you can read them in whatever order you want. But it's right there. I'm not tired. And it talks about worshiping with a pure heart. So what's the answer to the question? Well, the answer is never as explicit as you would like, nor for some of you as concise as you would like. But I thought William Temple did a fairly good job when he talking about worship says, it is the submission of all of our nature to God. It is the quickening of conscience by His holiness, purifying our imagination or thoughts by His beauty, opening of the heart to His love, and submission of the will to His purpose. All this gathered up in adoration is the greatest expression of which we are capable. He says it's a response to the holiness of God. It's the purification of our thoughts because of the beauty of God. It's the opening up of our heart to His love, and it's the submission of our will to His will and His purpose. I'm sure we could fine-tune that, add to that, but I thought that was worthy of consideration. So I guess for me, worship is when the heart, will, conscience, imagination or thoughts, and actions all coalesce together. And when we do that, then I think we can have unity within ourselves, and maybe most importantly, unity with God. And when you and I are united with God, then we are going to automatically be united one with another. It's like spokes in a wheel. When the spokes are properly aligned with the hub of the wheel, then the spokes will, by definition, be aligned with one another. There are various ways of worship. There is public worship. There is private worship. I do not think private worship can take the place of public worship. That's why I can't go on a vacation and with my family privately worship God on the Lord's Day and think that takes the place of assembling with the saints. But there is a place for both public and private worship. But I do exhort us to always remember that God has to be the primary audience and focus of our worship. Any activity that does not have God as the primary audience and focus, I don't personally consider that to be worship. Another question. What should be done if we feel discipline is not being administered where it is necessary? Should we speak to the elders first? I understand action is sometimes being taken that I may not know about or be in a position to follow. And I made myself some notes on this card, so let me find it. Here it is. This sometimes happens, and I think, I don't know who this question is from, but I really like the last sentence. An understanding that, you know, we may not know everything that's going on. In fact, as members of our congregation, there are many things that our elders are doing that we don't know about. We appreciate it, and it's not always appropriate for us to know about it. I listed a few passages here that you might want to consider. Some of these have already been referenced. I think John was referencing Matthew 18 where it says if you've got a problem with someone, you go one-on-one. If that doesn't work, you take two or three with you. If that doesn't work, you bring it before the congregation. For me, the principle there is let's address these things at the lowest level possible with the fewest people involved that don't need to be involved. We don't tend to always do it that way. Maybe we don't even usually do it that way, but I think that is the biblical way. So in a case like this, if discipline is not being administered where it's necessary, if it is not known and you're the only person that knows this other person is having the problem, I think you should go to them first. Now, if it's a situation where it's known and it's maybe the many in the congregation know about it or maybe the elders know about it and you just don't see anything happening, then I would say, yeah, go talk to the elders. They may be able to tell you, we're working on it. And if they tell you that, and you have confidence in them, which you should, then that's good. Let them handle it. However, maybe they're not aware of it. And maybe they're human. Maybe they could use a little encouragement and nudging or knowing that you're with them. Because this is not a fun thing to do. Maybe they could give you some guidance as to what you could do to help the situation. But I've gone to my elders on several occasions when I am aware of something and kind of said to them, hey, I don't want to mess up anything you're doing. But is there anything I can do to help, or is there any information that would be helpful to you? And sometimes they have something that would be good for me to do, and sometimes it's obvious to me. They're on top of it, they're working on it, and we don't need 14 chiefs. We just need to make sure that it's being addressed. So, 1 Corinthians 5 is the young man, or at least man, who has some immorality in his life. I put that in there because we need to remind ourselves that when congregation, when discipline in our midst is necessary, it is congregational discipline, not simply elder discipline. Yes, the elders may need to take a lead in that, or whoever has the leadership in your congregation. But we as a congregation are doing it, not just the elders or the evangelist, if you have an evangelistic oversight. In 1 Timothy 1, John has alluded to, is that 1 Timothy or 2nd? Anyway, the one I want is Hymenaeus, when they're delivered over to Satan. There's two times that phrase is used in the scriptures, 1 Timothy 5 and then again 1 Corinthians 5 and then in Timothy, that idea of turning them over to Satan. You want to talk about a sobering phrase, turning them over to Satan, but it's for, as has been expressed, not only for their good, but for the good of the congregation. I'll be happy to talk to any of you or whoever submitted this question in more detail if you would like, but those are my concise thoughts. Another question. How does the MDR, that's marriage, divorce, and remarriage for those of us whose fingers get tired, how does the MDR issue affect the ability to serve in the church? I understand that it eliminates the service of an officer, but does it disqualify in other areas as well? Can it appear that we are accepting sin by allowing their service? If I understand that question, there's really two or three questions there. I'm going to assume, because it doesn't make any sense if I don't, that we're talking about a situation where there's been a marriage, a divorce, and maybe a remarriage that isn't scriptural. If all of this is scriptural, then my answer is they should be used in any way they are capable of being used, at least in the service. Another side comment before I get maybe to the ultimate answer, the idea of it eliminating them as being a potential officer. This is an area of probably judgment to some extent. Obviously, if it's an unscriptural situation, obviously they are not eliminated. The question sometimes comes up, if a man has been divorced, has the right to remarry, and then remarries, is he automatically disqualified from being an officer? My feeling is it is probably unwise in most cases for that man to serve for several reasons. One of them being it may just be a constant question mark in people's minds. Usually there's more than, I use the phrase, there's usually dirt on both sides of the nickel, even though most of it may be on one side. So I think we need to be very, very careful. I have never appointed a man to the office who has been in a situation like that. I know of officers that we are in our brotherhood that are in situations like that, and I leave that to the judgment of whoever appointed them and their congregation. But the idea of just using an individual like this in the service, well, again, if everything was scriptural, I have absolutely no reason to not use them in the service. They're a brother or a sister teaching the classes, whatever it might be. Now, if it is not scriptural, I think things like that need to be addressed before anybody is used in the service. Whether it's MDR, or whether it's drunkenness, or whether it's fornication, or immorality. It's been a few years, but a couple was concerned in their congregation because the person officiating at the Lord's table obviously to them had alcohol on his breath when he came to church. Well, we can discuss whether or not drinking is wrong versus drunkenness, but it would seem to me like that is not a very good precedent at all. And when we just turn our face to sin and continue on in our worship services as if everything is okay. To me, that is problematic to be nice about it and wrong to be more accurate about it. So I think we need to be quite careful about that. I don't think it automatically, but I think if there is sin in the camp, that the sin needs to be addressed or the camp's going to suffer. And I would hope those that we use in a public way, certainly, are people who, to the best of their ability or our knowledge, have their lives in order. Now, I could open this up right now and take the rest of the class, so I won't. I want to talk a little bit about the family. Families are nice. Families are wonderful. This is members of a family. They're happy. And probably for many, many reasons, they should be happy. Every family has some... Well, you just read it. And if it applies to you, I can say that I don't know who the weird one is in our family. Facebook, here we come. But Satan, seriously, I think that last one was kind of serious, but it's funny. But funny things are usually funny because they have a smattering of truth to them, don't they? But Satan certainly is attacking the family. If I were Satan, and I'd say, how do I want to win? I'd say, go after the family, because that's going to affect our civil government, and it's going to affect the church. And I think he's attacking all of them, but he is certainly attacking the family. And there is not a family here that Satan does not or is not having an effect on. That's just an absolute truth. My family has issues. Your family has issues. I have issues. You have issues. So let's just be honest about it. There's probably not a family here that hasn't been affected by marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Maybe not you, and maybe not your closest kin, but you don't have to go very far on that tree to find it. That doesn't make it better. It just makes it that we're all in the boat. It's affecting our homes. It's affecting our marriages. It's affecting our parenting. It's affecting our children. But the principle still holds true. Only spiritual solutions can solve spiritual problems. And family problems are spiritual problems. That's just a fact. Now, if you're unemployed and having trouble supporting your family, I'm not saying that's because you're not spiritual. But the really important family problems are they're spiritual. They're spiritual. So it seems to me the solutions have to be spiritual. This has been talked about, but we're going to do it one more time. This is our societal hot button on marriage. And it's not right. I know it. You know it. But it is going to be something that those of us that live very much longer are going to have to deal with within the church, and certainly our children, our grandchildren are going to have to deal with it. I also want to give you a few scriptures. We've been reading press releases and all this, and not that these scriptures haven't been given, but in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 9 and 10, it's a list of sins, and one of them is effeminate. A male engaged in homosexual activity. And it's listed. Is it worse than any of the other sins? Well, it's not worse in the sense that all sin leads us to lost souls. But it does seem, at least in our culture, to be an issue that our young people and those of us that are older are having to struggle with. And I've come face to face with it, not in my family, but I've come face to face with it in my church work this last year, more than in the previous 20 years. And maybe that's just my sensitivity to it, or maybe it's catching up with us. In Jude, verse 7, there's a reference there to strange flesh. We've touched on this in Romans. We're in Romans chapter 1, verse 26 and 27. It talks about women going to unnatural affections and men going to unnatural affections. That's what it's talking about. There are other passages, but I just wanted to make sure I gave some scripture for those of you that would like to consider it. There is no, and what I mean by that, there is no neutral zone on this issue. There isn't that 10-mile DMZ zone like we have in between North and South Korea. As Christians or as people, you've got to take a position on this. You can not think about it, but that's a position as far as I'm concerned. Jason Jackson, in one of his articles, says, God does not discriminate. All sin is horrible, as demonstrated by the death of Jesus Christ on the cross. Penitents are saved because their sins are forgiven, but others will die lost. Measure a society by what is considered normal, and ours is not unlike those tolerant cities of old, Sodom, Gomorrah, Corinth. Perversion is glorified. Sodomy is the way God made me. One proof of our degenerate world is the confusion over the anatomy of men and women and their compatibility. John Piper, there is no demilitarized zone on the issue of homosexuality. You can Google and read that article. I found it to be fairly good on it. But I don't think more press releases or even more scriptures are the issue. We just have to come to grips and stand for what we know the Bible teaches. So I ask the question, because I think this is a question in the not too distant future. What would you do? And what I'm alluding to, what would you do, or what would your congregation do, if someone who is practicing this comes forward for membership or baptism? If it hasn't happened, it probably will. What would you do? Would you force them to no longer be married? What would be our position? Well, let me give you my thoughts on that, and then we will move on. Anybody who comes forward with a truly repentant heart wanting to be baptized, I am not going to stand in their way. God does not put a lot of lists of things we have to understand. Think back, if you were baptized young, you probably didn't understand much. But if you understood enough, you were baptized. So I'm not going to stand in that way. Having said that, anybody that comes forward in a congregation that I am involved with, at least, my thought would be, membership, baptism, fine, but the conduct cannot continue. And that would be the position I would take for an alcoholic. It would be the position I would take for fornication. It would be the position I would take for stealing. This is just a back-of-the-neck, hair-raising issue right now for us. I remember some years ago, close to 20, I was having a Bible study with a couple, and they weren't engaged in this. They were simply living together without marriage. And they, after this Bible study, decided, we want to be baptized. Well, that's great. But then I thought, okay, now what? And so we talked about it. What happened is, it worked out. I baptized them at 10 a.m. and performed their wedding at 11 a.m. so they could go home as husband and wife. I said, I can't baptize you and then you just go right back living in sin. And they were willing to do that. It was a small service. But it was a real highlight for me. I thought, that's right, you know. Everybody's welcome, but not all conduct is welcome. Our children are being taught that this is largely a genetic issue. I believe genetics has something to do with it. By that I mean, I think each of us are genetically presupposed so that certain temptations are greater for us than others. Some here may have a greater temptation to alcohol. Some here may have a greater temptation to pornography. Some here may have a greater temptation toward this. I don't know. I know what my temptations are. I got enough work to do to handle them. But having said that, there is no genetic predisposition that causes us to sin. There may be a genetic tendency that causes that to be a greater temptation, but Paul was quite clear in 1 Corinthians 10:13, there is no temptation taken us that is beyond our ability to withstand. Is it more of a temptation? This is not a temptation for me. It really isn't. But I'm glad chocolate's not a sin. Because that is. Okay? My point is not to be really humorous. It's that we need to have some compassion, but we... And you young people, you're being taught, well, not just young people, in the press, it's genetic. We're born that way. No. Maybe with some tendencies, but not with a compulsion to have to sin. Enough of that. Not that we've exhausted it, I'm just tired of, I don't want to think about it right now. Because heterosexual marriages are having plenty of trouble of their own. So let's not get feeling too good about ourselves if that past one is not something we have to deal with. There are problems galore in heterosexual marriage. I like what Paul Sweeney said. The wedding anniversary is a celebration of love, trust, partnership, tolerance, and tenacity. And the order varies for any given year. I don't know Paul Sweeney, but I know he was married. If you've been married longer than a couple of years, you're still married because of not simply love and trust, but tolerance and tenacity. Maybe those are other words for commitment. What are some of the problems? Well, the problems are not minor, and we'll go through them. We'll go through a few of them because there is such a multiplicity. I believe Satan and his minions have largely been involved in this deterioration. Now, I'm fully aware of what James tells us in James chapter 1. You know, if we do it, it's our fault. Everything I do wrong is my fault. Everything you do wrong is your fault. Everything we do wrong is our fault. So let's put the blame where it belongs. But Satan is very gleeful. One of the areas I think it would be the reversal of biblical roles. When Satan came to Eve in Genesis chapter 3, he told her in essence, you don't have to listen to God. I'm going to tell you how it really is. But there's even a further ramification. If Eve doesn't have to listen to God, she sure doesn't have to listen to Adam. Because Adam wasn't God. If I don't have to listen to God, then I sure don't have to listen to you because you're not even close to God. So we have this stress on the family, oh, so very, very early. Whenever the roles are reversed, you have a context where Satan can enter into that relationship. And it almost always results in conflict in a marriage. And we saw the result of some conflict in Genesis chapter 3. I don't have time to go into this in huge detail. I am not against women working outside of the home. My wife has done that, is doing that. She didn't start doing it until the kids went to school. And that's one of the great ironies. When you're young and you have your kids, that's when you need the money the most. And then when you get old and the kids leave, then the wife's more free to work when you don't need the money. Donna works just to have something to kind of do when I'm gone. And I think that's appropriate. I am not against women working outside of the home, but ladies, always keep the home your number one priority. And don't let the home suffer because you're doing it. I don't care whether you do or you don't. I can make a real case that I'd rather you raise your kids than work outside of the home. And I'm trying to use that phrase, work outside of the home, because working inside of the home is sometimes harder than working outside of the home, which is why I think some people work outside of the home, because they don't want to work inside of the home. That's true. We have kids that we don't want. It's not that we don't love them, but we don't want to raise them once we have them. And I know I'm somewhat speaking to the choir, but I'm not against it. I'm just saying let us be very, very, very cautious about the role reversal. Men, you are to lead your families. Some of you ladies are married to wimps who aren't leading your family, and it puts you in a terrible position. About the only thing I can tell you is you're going to have to do what needs to be done, but don't let your husband get away with that. Figure out ways to force him to lead. And if you're not married, don't marry somebody that won't lead you, ladies. And if you can't follow his lead, I know exactly what you should do. Don't marry him. And guys, if she won't follow your lead as a Christian man, don't marry her. I think another problem is anger and disrespect within the home. When there is anger and disrespect in any relationship, it's a problem. Rebellion in 2 Peter chapter 2 uses the term self-willed. I don't know how many of you have talked to people that are having marital problems. Probably a vast majority of you. We don't consider ourselves marriage counselors. I don't know that I'm qualified for that. I can just counsel on what the Bible says about it. And if that's a marriage counselor, then so be it. But many times when I'm talking to people that are having problems, they will always, you'll hear the word I. So often. And they'll have the mindset, would you talk to them and get them to change? Well, I might be willing to talk to them, but when we come with the attitude of that self-will I, we've got a problem. That's true in any relationship. Manifests itself maybe more in marriage. Selfishness, that probably goes along with what I just said. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, talks about not defrauding ourselves one from another in a marriage relationship. And I think that has sexual implications. But that's selfish. Ladies, please do not go into this. If you don't do that, you're not going to get this mindset, because you are in for you're going to be in for problems. And if it persists, he will find it somewhere else, unless he's an awfully strong man. There's a verse in Nehemiah 4 that really had kind of escaped me, to be honest with you, and I'm intrigued with it enough that I'm going to turn and read it for you, because I think it's a good admonition for all of us. And I looked and rose up and said unto the nobles and to the rulers and to the rest of the people, be not you afraid of them. Remember the Lord, which is great and terrible. And listen to this. Fight for your brethren, for your sons, for your daughters, for your wives, and for your houses. Now, in that context, I think we're talking about a physical battle to protect our families. But I love that phrase. Fight for your family. It's worth fighting for. You probably won't have to get a gun. You probably won't need a sword other than this one. But if you are married, it is worth fighting for. If you have children, they are worth fighting for. Certainly in the spiritual sense, every bit as much as in the physical sense. Every parent here, I believe, would do whatever it takes to protect their children from dying. We'd give our lives for them. I've always kind of been amazed how many parents would throw themselves in front of a car to save their children, but they won't take their children to church in order to save them or teach them what the scriptures teach. Just a few scriptures on this, and I touched on these yesterday. Wade's going to touch on some of them. He's obviously going to touch on Matthew 5 because that's part of the Sermon on the Mount. But passages on marriage, Matthew 19, verse 9 in particular is strong with me. If we get divorced for any other reason than sexual infidelity, we don't have the right to remarry. Is that harsh? Well, it's biblical. 1 Corinthians 7, Paul talks about this issue. Ephesians 5, Paul's longest passage on the husband-wife relationship. 1 Peter 3, the first 5 or 6 verses there are talking about how an unbelieving wife should nurture her. No, a believing wife should nurture her unbelieving husband. And there are some wonderful examples of that in this midst. Of women who have gently and sometimes very successfully brought their husbands to the Lord, even late in years. And that's just a wonderful, wonderful thing to see. But in verse 7, it talks to us husbands about how to understand and to treat our wives. That was a prompt for me to forget, not do this. And I don't know if you can... Is that readable? I didn't know if it would be too dark or not. This was a little thing I found. It was written by Michael Haas, who is a judge in Minnesota. And in 2001, he wrote this to divorcing parents. He said, "Your children have come into this world because of the two of you. Perhaps you two made lousy choices as to who you decided to be the other parent. If so, that's your problem and that's your fault. No matter what you think of the other party or what your family thinks of the other party, these children are one half of each of you. Remember that, because every time you tell your child what an idiot his father is, or what a fool his mother is, or how bad the absent parent is, or what terrible things that person has done, you are telling the child that half of them is that or bad. That is an unforgivable thing to do to a child. That is not love. That is possession. If you do that to your children, you will destroy them as surely as if you had cut them into pieces, because that is what you are doing to their emotions. I sincerely hope that you do not do that to your children. Think more about your children and less about yourselves, and make yourselves a selfless kind of love, not foolish or selfish, or your children will suffer." Well, I don't mind being an amen guy right now, because I just say amen. And you and I have heard, and maybe some of us have, I haven't because I haven't gone through that, have uttered the words, "The children will get over it." Well, remember my Greek word from last week? The hogwash. They may survive it, but surviving it is different than getting over it. Some of you have survived it and are wonderful Christians, so maybe you've kind of got over it, but there's some scars in there that will always be. I was blessed. Loving parents, loving wife, loving children. That could change. Not all of us have been blessed quite that same way. I think this is true. The real power of a man is the size of the smile of the woman sitting next to him. But understand, a smile and a smirk are two different things. And I can't always tell the difference. I like this next picture, but it's a little unrealistic, but I'm putting it here anyway. Little girl's first date. It's with her dad. What I don't like about this picture is, well, what kind of a dork has a suit on in a playground? So he may be a pervert, I don't know. But the thought is good. Yeah, I don't have any daughters, and so I can't really speak for this, but I always remember that quote about something to the effect, when a father sees his daughter go out on the first date, it's kind of like turning over this Stradivarius to a gorilla. And he just doesn't quite know what to do with it. But we learn so much from our parents and the way we are treated. And I just think that's a wonderful sentiment for parenting. But parenting doesn't always get the results we want. They've been asking me all week when it was coming. They didn't know what was coming. But their parents really had great hopes for them. Two of my favorite people. If this doesn't cure you people from putting things on Facebook, I don't know what will. Shut it down. Okay, seriously. Obviously, parenting starts with love. I don't need to tell you that. You know that. And you love your parents and you love your children. It deserves to be the primary thing I talk about, but I don't think I need to. I want to talk just a little bit about discipline. I thought about waiting till tomorrow to do this, because then I'll be leaving town. Parents have different approaches to discipline. But I do remember very much the Proverbs that says, you know, if you spare the rod, you spare the child. It is my belief there is a place in disciplining our families for, shall I say, physical punishment. Is that the only way? No. I was a parent when our boys were young before all this timeout stuff came in. And I don't think that's wrong. I think that has a place. But I do think there is a place where we need to at least make sure we do discipline them because we love them. And that's what Hebrews 12:5 says God does to us. He chastens whom He loves. I remember giving a talk on parenting back when I thought I knew how to do it. And I made this statement in there, and Brandon and Shane were in the audience. I said, you know, I don't really remember having to spank them very often because they knew that it was there if they didn't behave. Well, we got home, they had a whole long list of things they had remembered when they got spanked. I just didn't remember them. But it worked out. Each family works this out. But I do think that we may succumb to a modern psychological bent that it's wrong to spank our children or it's cruel to spank our children. And you know I'm not talking about beating them. I'm talking about correcting them. When we take our children out, i.e. from an assembly like this, and this has been, I know they're in class while I'm up here, but I just haven't heard much. But if we have to take our children out for a disciplinary reason, they should understand there is a consequence to be taking out, and it's not a joyous thing. I remember I grew up in Martinsville, Indiana, and I was sitting about where Dwayne is. Dwayne. And Mom was sitting with my sister behind her. I don't know what she did. She misbehaved. She got up and started walking back. My sister's name's Karen. And Karen screams at her loud voice, Mom, don't spank me! And the whole church started laughing. But she knew what was coming. I sat there going, yes! It was wonderful. Most of you don't know my sister, but she was an only child. Okay. There are different styles of parenting. I'm not going to go into this. There's the dictator, there's the overprotective, there's the permissive, but there's one right way. And that's the biblical way. And I think it's a mixture of all of those. There's sometimes when we need to be firm, there's sometimes when we need to give them some slack, and there's sometimes when we need to let them grow. But they are a tremendous responsibility. You do not have to have children to be saved. You do not have to be married to be saved. And I can make a lot of good reasons for having them and some reasons for some people not having them. But if you choose to have them, they are a tremendous responsibility and treat them appropriately. We could spend a lot of time on parenting and probably don't need to spend. I like this one. And I'm not even going to say anything. Well, our children, our grandchildren, need to see us in the Word of God. One of my highlights as a parent, and I'm not going to say I took the boys out and sat under a tree and read the Bible. That's almost too good. But one of my highlights as a parent, I happened to be walking by one of the boys' rooms. They were probably 13, 14. We had a little desk for them to do their homework. And I looked in, and they were reading the Bible. I'm going to save this next one for tomorrow, the area of responsibility for educating our children.